The Future Proof Podcast from News Talk.
Proudly supported by Science Foundation Ireland. Hashtag believe in science.
Hello and welcome to Future Proof the Podcast. This is the show where we take a closer look at the world around us. I'm Jonathan McRae. If you'd like to feel the dopamine squirt of having your name called out in the program, you can email us at science@newstalk.com. You can also find us on Twitter. We're at News Talk Science. We get to your comments from last week at the end of the podcast. Coming up on this week's program, we're going to be talking about this really weird material called starlight. It sort of has a legendary quality. It was invented by this British hairdresser in the 1970s and 80s. And he basically invented this material that you could paint onto surfaces and give them an amazing heat resistant quality, like something the world has never seen. You could paint an egg and then use a flamethrower and the egg would stay raw. Like, amazing stuff by all accounts. But he kept the recipe to it very secret. And then he died. And there's been a resurgence of interest in this particular material, with one YouTuber claiming that they may have been able to recreate that exact recipe. It's a fascinating story. We're going to be hearing all about it from that YouTuber himself in a few minutes' time. First, though, it's time to look back at the week's science news. And joining me via Skype are the esteemed doctors Shane Bergen from UCD and from DCU, Dr. Susan Kelleher. You are both very welcome. Our first story.
And you've already got a beautiful, creamy sauce. So I'm going to turn it down to low because I've got no rush now. I'm happy. Some puff pastry. Buy it, pre-done, and then you just put that pastry on here.
I'm going to give you the benefit of the doubt, Aidan, that when I asked you to find a clip about pie for the top of the show, that you knew I wasn't talking about that sort of pie. I'm going to give you the benefit of the doubt. And our first story has to do with pie, but not that sort of pie. Mathematical pie. 3.14159265395. I think that's about right. I've lost. I used to know it to quite a few numbers, and now I think I've forgotten it all. Anyway. This has to do with pie, Shane. Not Jamie Oliver's pie. Magical mathematical pie.
Yes. P-I, not P-I-E. And it's not magical. It's transcendental and irrational, the number pi. Yeah. It's irrational in that the number pi cannot be expressed as the fraction of two whole numbers, right? So, like, the number 2 could be expressed as 100 over 50. And so that makes it rational. It's transcendental.
Oh, I thought it was like, so it's not 22 over 7 or something like that.
No, that's just a very crude approximation. So instead of it being like an equals to line, you'll see in mathematics, it's kind of a wavy equals to line, which means it's almost equal to. The number pi is transcendental because it's not possible to define it using a whole equation of numbers. But perhaps taking a step back, what is pi in the first place? If you take anything that's circular and you express the circumference, the bit around the edge, over the diameter, that's the number pi. And so humans have played with circles since we've been clever enough to think. And so we've always known about the existence of this number, and we have long grappled with our inability to express it. And it's kind of become a little bit of a pet project for lots of mathematicians. This week in Switzerland, mathematicians there calculated pi to a staggering 6.2 trillion figures. And they did that over 108 days. They did that 3.5 times faster than the 2020 record of 50 trillion digits. People are asking, well, why would you do this? You know, can you do better calculations? Can you do better science with this? No, is the short answer. It would only take 65 digits of pi to know the size of the observable universe within the Planck length, which is the shortest measurable distance. So there is no scientific reason for doing this.
It's a urinating contest, essentially.
In a sense, to put it crudely, yes, it is.
I could have said pissing contest, but I didn't.
It's a computational curiosity. But doing that does improve our ability to improve supercomputers. And that's very useful for lots of applicable things. So, you know, whilst these curiosities just could be seen as, Asher, why would you bother? A lot of the time, that kind of stuff and number theory and maths has led to discoveries and has led to a capacity to think in a certain way. It's pretty cool.
But there has been criticism over using these supercomputers to calculate pi that could be otherwise used to figure out I don't know, something more useful or something about our universe, crunching data to do with DNA, perhaps?
Yeah, I've been thinking about that, and I thought, well, maybe it's just easy for, like, the mathematicians have to be focused on how the computer works. It's up to other people to do the science with it. So they use something like Pi as just kind of a test, you know, a quick and easy thing that's very reliable for them to work on the computation rather than to be focused on the science. So I would not criticize these people at all. The amount of money that goes to mathematical research is a fraction of what goes to science research, you know, so more power to them.
Susan, our second story has to do with green steel. What on earth is that?
Yeah, so we know that steel production is a huge producer of CO2. In fact, it counts for about 5% of all CO2 emissions worldwide. And believe it or not, for every ton of steel produced, 1.9 tons of CO2 are emitted. But, you know, unlike your, I don't know, bamboo toothbrush or things that you can do on your own, you know, changes you can make, it's actually really difficult to make a viable alternative to steel. We need steel, it's everywhere, and we can't really do without it. And in fact, then also a modern economy, each person needs 12 tons of steel just for, you know, for the car that you use and the roads that you drive on. So steel industry is now looking at how steel can be made in a more sustainable way. And the problem with steel, to understand this, the problem with steel is that production is there's two reactions. You take carbon, react it with oxygen, and you make CO, so carbon monoxide. That carbon monoxide is then reacted with iron ore, which is iron and oxygen together in a compound. And that makes then iron and CO2. Now, iron, steel is 99% iron, so that's where the iron then goes to make the steel. But you've all this CO2 left over. And moreover, you're starting with carbon, which comes from coal. So it's a really dirty process. So what people are doing, in there's a company called Hybrit in Sweden. Now, Sweden also has a really large steel industry. So there's a few companies together that have, are working together on a pilot plant to do what's called a direct reduction. So you're removing those two steps and you're making just one step. And instead of using carbon monoxide to do the reducing of the iron ore, they're using hydrogen. So you now have an equation that says hydrogen plus iron ore gives you iron plus water, which is much better than CO2 as a byproduct. So it's a really interesting concept. It's something that I think we're going to have to go towards in terms of, you know, being able to produce this in a sustainable way. The challenges there are producing enough hydrogen sustainably. So they're looking at that. All the partners are involved looking at that. Mm. Understanding the process. I mean, we've known how iron is made for, steel has been made for centuries. So we have to rethink how we're going to do this. So there's understanding how much hydrogen is needed and how it's processed. And then finally, hydrogen storage, because you need to be able to store the hydrogen and then release it when you need it in your furnace, etc. So I think it's a terrific initiative, and it's going to have to be, you know, the way forward for the steel industry. They do have a terrific website, I have to say. It's Hybrit, is the Hybrit is the name of the company. But they have all their papers that they've published. It's all open. They're really like forward in terms of letting people know how they're doing what they're doing. So it's a great initiative, this new pilot plant.
Can I just admit something really embarrassing? I had no idea steel was made from iron.
It should be called irony stuff. And then, of course, so different types of steel are made with different components. So like steel is 99% iron, but then you've slightly small different amounts of carbon or different things that are added to change the properties of the steel. And that's then made as people need it.
What about the amount of energy that goes in to do this process? Surely that in itself would emit a lot of carbon.
Yeah, so this pilot plant, it looks at everything. So it looks at, you know, how the electricity is used to the electrolysis, etc. So it's a really, it's a full package thing.
Oh, that sounds really cool. Slightly further away on the horizon, I suppose, Shane, as it always has been, sort of like the end of the world is nuclear fusion. But an update on developments there.
Yeah, nuclear fusion, which is always supposed to be 20 years away. And I can come back to that and comment on it. This is news from the National Ignition Facility in the US, where they are firing a whopping 192 lasers at a tiny capsule of hydrogen fuel in order to heat it up such that it gets hotter than the center of the sun. And the hydrogen in that starts to fuse and create helium. And as a byproduct of that fusing, it gives off energy. And that's the basis of nuclear fusion, which is different to fission, where we split heavy atoms apart, like uranium. And on August 8th, they did an experiment where That was 70% efficient. So the energy out was 70% of the energy in. Now you might think that's not great because no power plant can run that way. But this is eight times better than the previous best experiment. And so they're saying that they're making steady progress towards reaching a point called ignition, where the energy out would be greater than the energy in. And that's when it's a viable way to make energy and electricity, not make energy, but, you know, produce energy. So they also say that they're burning plasma. They're at burning plasma temperatures, which is fantastic because that means that the fusion reactions that are happening are able to sustain other fusion next to it. So it's a sort of trickle down effect. And that's very important if you want to start a reaction and keep it going. So there is lots still to do, but they know where to go. Getting back to your point about it always being 20 years away, I was looking up how much money is invested in nuclear fusion research. It's absolutely tiny. If we want to be serious about this, we need to invest in it like the way we've invested in COVID vaccines. If we can crack this nut, we have free fuel forever with no greenhouse gases.
It seems like a real lottery situation, right? And the more tickets you buy, the more likely you are to win, because absolutely nuclear fusion would change everything. Really interesting. Dr. Shane Bergen and Dr. Susan Kelleher, thanks very much for joining us. Now, our next story is a bit of folklore, a mysterious material that could be made in your home with incredible properties exists. But the recipe for it is secret and the inventor is dead. It is, or was, a material that could have changed the world, and chances are you've never heard of it. It's called starlight. To hear the story, we turn to the belly of Mysterious Tales and Urban Legends YouTube, and Ben Cusick has a channel called Nighthawk in Light. He joins me now to explain. Welcome to the programme, Ben. I have to say, this is one of those stories that when I heard it, I wasn't sure how we could cover it, because just information on it seems tricky to grasp. Can you maybe start off by telling us who Maurice Ward was and what we know about him and his creation?
Yeah, thanks, Jonathan. So Maurice Ward was a British hairdresser. He was an amateur inventor who saw an airline disaster in the 80s. And according to what he has said, he set out to invent a material that would have prevented that disaster from happening, where many people died in an airline fire.
What I love about this is there's so little details that we can fully confirm, and lots of mystery about the man himself on purpose. This was a secret recipe. But we do know that he demonstrated this even on Tomorrow's World, a sort of legendary science program here on this side of Europe. He demonstrated the properties of starlight. Can you tell us what starlight was able to do?
Yeah, so starlight was a material that could withstand extremely high temperatures for long periods of time, and it would insulate from that high heat. And one of the famous demonstrations that really made this material stick in people's minds is on the program Tomorrow's World. It was demonstrated being coated onto a raw egg, and then a butane torch would be held against it for upwards of 5 minutes. And then the presenter of Tomorrow's World walks back over to the egg after he's done looking at all these other demonstrations. Meanwhile, the torch has been burning the whole time, takes the egg, turns off the torch, cracks it open, and it's completely raw after minutes and minutes being under 1500 degrees Celsius flame. So it's an incredibly heat-resistant material. There are some various properties of the material that make it so. But the properties that actually provide the heat protection were a closely guarded secret, along with its ingredients. And actually, Maurice Ward stated on several occasions that he did not, in fact, know how his material worked, just that it did.
I mean, when you think about that, the demonstration of coating an egg and putting it under intense heat for 5 minutes and it not being cooked, like the commercial potential of that was huge. So what happened to Maurice Ward's recipe for starlight? And why is it not on all of the things we need to make flame resistant or fire resistant now?
Yeah, so Morris Ward, after inventing his material, he was a fantastic showman. And so he went around doing demonstrations of this material in public all over the place, and spoke with many companies that wished to purchase it from him and turn it into a product that would make it into people's homes or into airplanes. But Morris Ward seems to have been quite reluctant to share his invention. He had fear that people were going to steal it or somehow cut him out of the profits if he made the recipe known. And so as he was approached by companies, inevitably he would fail to reach a deal where they would, you know, basically give him enough money up front that he thought it would be worthwhile for him to share the recipe so that they could make it themselves. Much of this is rumor because, well, obviously private business negotiations and things like that are not documented for anyone to see.
And he died. He died in 2011, aged 78. And with him, the recipe, it seems. Now, before we talk about where that recipe may have turned up since then, I wanted to ask you how you're involved in all of this. You're a YouTuber and came across this story. What inspired you about it, and what did you decide to do?
Yeah, so that is exactly how this happened, is I just came across this story through a program on the BBC, a more modern retelling of the story of starlight. And I have a background in amateur chemistry myself, especially in as it relates to the chemical compositions and reactions involved with fireworks. And as I saw this story of starlight, and I noticed some of the properties that it had in the available footage of it being used, I recognized it having very similar characteristics to a type of firework called a pharaoh snake firework. It's kind of a children's firework, where it's a small pellet that you light on fire, and it just makes a big long tail of ash. There's not much flame or sparks. It just it ejects all this carbon foam, and it kind of looks like a snake. And I realized that in the footage of starlight being tested, that's a very similar effect that we see happening on the surface of starlight as what I saw in these pharaoh snake fireworks. So that's how it connected to my area of expertise, and making that connection, I was able to further deduct a little bit about how starlight most probably worked, and was able to attempt my own variations on its composition.
So you saw this story, you were inspired by it, you watched some footage and saw how it was being tested. You thought, I think I know what that looks like. And then you set to work trying to create your own miracle material, recreating starlight as best as you could. How well have you done in that pursuit?
Yeah, well, in fact, the very first day that I watched the documentary on starlight that first got me interested in it, immediately I had a basic idea of how I thought it worked. And I went out into my workshop, and by that afternoon I had something that I could hold in my hand, a thin pancake of material, and hold a torch against my hand with this material in it and not burn myself. What I've learned through this process is that this is a material that actually can be made with a whole variety of different ingredients, entirely different ingredients, and get a similar effect.
So what's happening on a molecular level? How is it able to resist heat so well?
Yeah, so starlight is seemingly in a class of materials called intumescence, which to intumesce simply means it expands when heated. So when a sample of, I won't say starlight necessarily, because I have not held a sample in my own hands, but when a sample of the material that I have created to behave similarly to starlight is exposed to flame, the surface carbonizes. It releases all of its volatile chemicals into the air, or they simply burn up in the flame, and it leaves a shell of carbon behind. This carbon is inflated with gas bubbles that are also released by the heat, and so it expands outward due to that heat. And basically that provides a layer of thermal insulation that isn't there until heat is applied. So it can sit there, it could be turned into a paint or something on a wall, and it's super thin until heat is applied. And then suddenly it expands, and it gives you all this thermal insulation that you didn't have before. And because it's made of carbon is very black, which is also good at releasing heat as infrared light. So that's a secondary way that it can reflect that heat away from the surface that you're trying to protect.
So this is kind of crazy to me. You saw this work by Morris Ward. The recipe for this magical material got lost. On the first day, you managed to recreate this material. Are there commercial materials available that have the same sort of properties, or are you holding a patent worth billions of dollars in your hand? Like, what am I missing here?
Well, let me clarify that on the first day, I definitely did not recreate what starlight was. And in fact, to this day, although I have made materials that I think have really impressive properties, starlight itself, without having a sample to compare it to, you can only know so much about how close you have gotten to the same formula. What else is out there in this category of fireproofing barriers? I've actually learned since my diving into this subject of starlight that this class of intumescent materials is actually very well established. It's been around for decades and decades. The earliest patents that I found for fireproofing materials that rely on intumescence are from the 50s. And you can actually buy paint for your home that is intumescent and provides really impressive fire protection.
Would these current intumescent materials pass the egg test?
That is a good question. Well, modern intumescent materials are made to protect primarily building materials from fire. So they probably would not pass the egg test, but I don't think that that's what they're trying to do. So the thing about intumescent materials is that in order for them to start offering that level of fire protection, they need to become heated enough that they carbonize. And so that requires something like 250 degrees Celsius at minimum. And so if you have a very thin layer of material that is 250 degrees Celsius on one side before it starts providing an insulative value, that probably would cook an egg on the other side, but it would not catch a wooden beam on fire. So modern intumescents are primarily concerned about just keeping what's behind them below that combustion point, not necessarily the point where if you painted it on your hand, you wouldn't get burned by a flame. So it's a little bit of a different goal. It's not so much about providing total heat protection as much as fire resistance.
But I'm thinking of California and the wildfires that they're having, and thinking this particular product, if we had the recipe, might have been very useful, or might still be very useful in that scenario. So that's all very interesting, but isn't it true that what is supposedly Morris Ward's original papers, they've now been found and commercially sold to a company that is now trying to make the original starlight?
Yes, that is that has been an interesting development very recently. I believe it was in 2013. all of Morris Ward's paperwork and his samples of starlight that apparently still existed up until this sale of all these things. It was questionable about whether there were any samples remaining and if anyone knew what was in starlight. It was presumed to be totally lost because up until very recently, no one had demonstrated that they actually had the formula for starlight. There were people that claimed they did, but no one actually could, you know, go on TV like Morris Ward did and show it off. But yeah, so in recent years, there's this company called Thermashield in the United States, and they have all of Morris Ward's files and samples and are attempting to commercialize. And so that would be really interesting to find out as they move forward in that process, how different starlight really is from other intumescent materials on the market.
Yeah, I mean, when you think about it, there must have been something there that piqued their interest. They must have, I mean, if you're a materials company and you're looking into this area, you must see something in those notes or see some promise in the demonstrations that makes me think this is better than what we have already. During his demonstrations, Morris Ward claimed that this could be resistant up to 10,000 degrees centigrade or a nuclear explosion. I mean, theoretically, I mean, is that theoretically possible?
Yeah, there is potential for that to be possible to a certain extent. You have to think about the different properties of something like a nuclear explosion and wonder about what aspects of that explosion starlight was actually being claimed to be resistant to, because a lot of the statements made about starlight were all encompassing and just not very rich with the actual data. As far as I can tell from the testing that was done on starlight by several high profile agencies,
like NASA had a look at this, Imperial Chemical Industries, a big chemical company in the UK, the Atomic Weapons Establishment.
Yeah. So all these organizations did tests on starlight, and it did stand up to some significant abuse. The question is, it really seems by what I've seen of the tests that this is the heat of that explosion. Obviously, if you put a bomb right next to starlight, it would shatter. I mean, it was something that you could paint onto something, and then in tomorrow's world, when the guy picks up the egg to crack it open and find out that it's uncooked, you can crack right through the starlight by hand. It's not durable in that sense. It's just highly heat resistant. So there is potential that it could withstand the heat of a nuclear explosion, but not the
impact,
the force of it. Yeah.
But that is a wonder material, something that you could paint thinly onto the surface of an egg or whatever it is you're trying to protect from heat, and it could withstand up to 10,000 degrees centigrade. These are claims, and so few of them we can validate now because the pieces are missing or in private hands. And all that's left for us to do is do what you've done, Ben, which is speculate as to how this was created and wonder about whether or not it was all a layer of smoke or not. But I suppose potentially only time will tell. Ben Cusack, YouTuber with Nighthawk in Light, thank you so much for bringing this story to our attention.
Yeah, thank you.